Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello everyone and welcome to Blogging Theology. Today I'm delighted to talk again to Yahya Burt. You're most welcome, sir.
Good afternoon, I guess, where we are anyway. And thank you, Paul, for having me back on. Salams to all of your viewers, and I'm happy to be back on Blogging Theology.
Salam to you. And for those who don't know, I'll just give a very brief summary of Yahya's biography. He's a community historian who's taught at the University of Leeds. He has an MPhil in social and cultural anthropology from the University of Oxford. And he has published over a dozen peer-reviewed articles on Islam in Britain and co-edited a title, British Secularism and Religion, Islam, Society and the State, published in 2016. Also, a paper, Islam in Victorian Liverpool, an Ottoman account of Britain's first mosque community. It's actually a book published in 2021. And also, he's published a collection of poems by Abdullah Quilliam, the famous Victorian Muslim, with Ron Gieves, which is highly recommended. Also, he lives in West Yorkshire with his family and two cats. He likes walking, he tells me, and being grumpy about the state of the world, which I imagine is pretty much a full-time occupation these days. And he can be reached on Twitter at YBurt, and I'll link to that in the description below. Today, Yahya has kindly agreed to do a presentation on his latest and very significant paper entitled Umar at the Margins, The Past, Present and Future of Muslim Minorities. Is a very significant contribution to our discussion. So would you like to introduce us to this subject?
Thank you, Paul. So I've got a PowerPoint presentation that I'm going to talk through.
I just put it up on the screen.
And I hope your viewers can see it.
Yep, I've just put it up so we can see the first slide there.
Okay, so this is, let me start off by saying that this is meant to be a conversation starter rather than making any kind of spurious claim to be definitive. It's a scoping report, it's conceptual, and it lays out some strategic recommendations. It draws on the concrete experiences of British Muslims and Muslims in the West more generally. So if we're talking about Muslim minorities everywhere, we can't pretend that we're talking from nowhere. Obviously, we're all coming from somewhere. I think the main question is, and we have this attempt to have these kind of broad discussions, sort of global discussions amongst Muslims, that when we have variable geometries, that we kind of end up, do we try to end up sharing the same set of challenges together and thinking them through? You could call it like the problem space of the Ummah and reviving it and so on. So what does reviving the Ummah look like for minorities if we set that up as a discussion? Obviously, we're going to be coming from different minorities and from different places, but it's recognizing that it's fruitful to think hard about these things and to get beyond reacting and start building really and acting in a sober way to assess our strengths and weaknesses and step forward from where we are. So that's a kind of the rationale behind writing this in the first place. So it's not some kind of manifesto at all, but it is trying to answer some big questions. I should say a little bit about the Eon Institute where I work. So it's a startup, it's new. The vision is to see a Muslim world that is united, independent, strong, prosperous, free of war and conflict and capable of resolving its own issues. And to that end, we published a paper written by a colleague of mine, Jahangir Mohammed, called Creating a Civilization of Islam. And that sets out 12 broad strategies to revive that civilization. Mm. And the key kind of concepts that it leans on is being Muslim-centric, of how do we achieve unification and unity, and how do we revive the civilization of Islam? Mm.
Okay, so can I just clarify a term, Ummah-centric. So what does that mean in everyday terms? So Ummah is what
can we come back to that? Because I'll unpack yep. that as we go along. Is that okay in the interest of time? Absolutely. So this is a think tank, and it's not an academic institute. So, you know, rather than having conclusions, we tend to have recommendations. I think that's the easiest way to look at it, you know, is that we try to think of ways of acting in the world rather than, you know, coming to a kind of conceptual clarity or something like that. Do you know what I mean? Or proving our argument. So obviously, you know, we tend to move to recommendations rather than conclusions. I think that's the easiest way to think about these sorts of intervention. And so in this paper, Ummah at the Margins, which came out in October, we are looking at Muslim minorities in particular. What role can Muslim minorities play in reviving Islamic civilization? And there's sort of three key concepts here. One is Muslim minority. Two is politics of Ummah, which again, Paul, sorry for your listeners and viewers, we'll come back to Ummah shortly. Mm-hmm. And then looking at varieties of power, hard and soft Islamic power. And I will explain and talk about all of these three key concepts in the forthcoming presentation.
Okay.
So we can't deal with all these papers today in this presentation, but all these sort of big questions, key questions, do get tackled in the report. But I'm not going to deal with all of them today. But let me go through them. This is to give your listeners and viewers an idea of the scope of the report and the kind of ground that it covers. So when it asks a very fundamental question, why does Muslim solidarity matter today? And why do Muslim, and within that, why do Muslim minorities matter? The second thing is, what overall conclusions can we draw about the state or condition of Muslim minorities today? Thirdly, what is distinct about politics of Ummah for Muslim minorities as opposed to other kinds of politics?
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
In the world, like nationalist politics. Mm. Fourthly, you know, what are the goals of the politics of Ummah for Muslim minorities? What goals might we set ourselves? And finally, and fifthly, you know, how do Muslim minorities empower themselves? What does empowerment look like? What is Islamic hard and soft power? You need to think about that when you're thinking about empowerment. Mm. And what obstacles impede the politics of Ummah for Muslim minorities? Obviously, we do not operate in an obstacle-free zone. So that also needs to be considered. So as you can see, you know, these are big, broad and wide questions.
Yes.
So the sort of fundamental the fundamental proposition of this report is the following. Solidarity for our Ummah thrives when we connect and empower the minority and majority Muslim worlds together.
Mm.
And the report sets out to kind of not only defend, but to propose and articulate this this proposition. So, you know, between one in four and one in five Muslims lives in a minority context. And over half of those are in India, in one country, in India, over 200 million.
That's a remarkable statistic, isn't it? Because India, we think, well, now it's presenting itself much more as a Hindu power, but you're saying over half of the minority Ummah actually lives in India. It's extraordinary.
That's right. And actually, that's also not just a demographic fact. It's a fact of great geopolitical importance, which the report dwells on. I think it matters tremendously that if India is pre-genocidal, as many observers now think, scholars of genocide now think, it matters tremendously how that minority is treated.
I don't agree on this now, sorry, I don't want to take up your time, but you just use this phrase pre-genocidal, which is extraordinarily alarming and significant, because you're talking about the killing of masses of people. So I just wanted just to highlight that and move on, because but this is an extraordinary statement to make.
Well, you know, I'm not the first person to make it. There are scholars of genocide, and a number of them have said that, including the site Genocide Watch, including, you know, say that India is showing all the signs of pre-genocidal indicators, like pogroms, with the connivance or active support of the police. Forcible removals, destruction of businesses, homes, and places of worship, intense and persistent demonization across politics, the media, intense discrimination in law, in business, and in life, in public institutions in general. So there are a number of indicators that are extremely worrying. And there have been moments of ethnic cleansing in India with its huge population, such as Gujarat in 2002, when 2,000 Muslims were killed, with the connivance of the authorities, most likely. So there have been warning signs before, but since the BJP came to power in 2014, this has only been intensifying. So. Anyway, our report doesn't just deal with India. We try to provide a sort of big picture overview of 31 Muslim minorities around the world, each of which has a population of over a million. So the smallest would be South Africa. Its population is about a million, going all the way up to India with over 200 million. So here we go, just to kind of give everyone a kind of overview. So the populations in green, the territories in green, are the Muslim majority countries. As you see, there's a sort of equatorial belt, I suppose, from Indonesia to Morocco. And then the territories or countries in orange are where these 31 Muslim minorities reside, with populations of over a million. And then the light green are any other countries with Muslim minorities under a million. But we don't deal with them directly in the report, because the populations would be too small, if you see what I mean, in some cases. So we focus on these larger minorities. So breaking those 31 minorities down, what was quite extraordinary, that when we did a big data analysis, we found sort of three groups, analytically speaking, three groups of minorities. The first are the key three. This is India, China, and Russia. All three are superpowers, economically, militarily. All three have historic Muslim minorities of longevity, of great connection to, and the development of Islamicate civilization as a whole, and all three have troubled relations with the minorities to varying degrees, including, you know, the question of survival, I suppose. And what marks out these key three states is that they present a real challenge for Muslims around the world to support them because of the complexity of geopolitics. And there will be many, many competing interests at play with their own agendas above and beyond the kind of what you could call a kind of virtuous Muslim solidarity, politics of virtuous Muslim solidarity, where you're trying to help them not just to survive, but in the long run to thrive, right? To do more than just survive. But you know, this is very difficult terrain to navigate for various reasons, because there's a lot of conflicting interests at play. It's not a straight issue to deal constructively and proactively into these situations if one wanted to offer support. So that's one, that's the key three. The other is, and the report sort of deals with them, has sections on each. The next group is the Africa 14. So you've got 14 sub-Saharan African states with populations of over a million, some very significant, like Ethiopia is 36 million. What's remarkable is that they all of these 14 societies have very high levels of religious freedom. And I think that's significant because if we think about, for instance, the Gambia, which is also in West Africa, but it's a Muslim majority society, it took Myanmar to the International Criminal Court to have the ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya Muslims classified as a genocide in international law in 2019. So that's sort of emblematic of the way in which we could view these free societies, religiously free societies, to support the religious freedoms of others. Other Muslim minorities and even religious freedoms of Muslim majority societies. But of course, they range from middle income countries like South Africa to some of the poorest societies in the world, like Mozambique, for instance. And then we have the final group, which is the Western Nine. These are all relatively new minorities. They all sort of really emerge fully in the 20th century. The exception is Bosnia, where Islam emerges in the 16th century. But they all have, comparatively speaking, relatively high incomes and relatively high levels of freedom. And so although they only number 30 million in total, these nine minorities only number 30 million, nonetheless, they have a chance to punch above their weight when it comes to making contribution and helping others.
I spoke to Dr. Abdullah Swedi a few days ago. He teaches at the University of Medina. He's a Swedish revert to Islam, about Islam in Sweden. And I thought there's a surprisingly high number of Muslims now in Sweden. 30% of youth in Sweden are Muslim. 30%. And I think it's actually over a million people in Sweden are now Muslim overall, actually. So that might...
We use one big data set dating from 2020. It may be that some have crept over the million mark, and you know, I don't think that it would invalidate the analysis if added Sweden into. But I'd be happy if there's another member of the Western Club.
I think there is. For a million. I did a video. It's going to be uploading soon. But he does talk about the stats, and I was surprised how high they were for Sweden demographically.
Yeah. There's been quite a lot of change in Sweden recently. So yeah, of course. But you know, it doesn't invalidate the overall analysis, I don't think. And then you know, talking about statistics. So this is where, you know, what's kind of remarkable was that we kind of did a measurement measuring, you know, individual wealth based on parity purchasing power, which, you know, allows for, you know, the ability of the local currency to buy a basket of everyday goods. And obviously, you know, so the cost of living is factored in. It's not a straight currency conversion into US dollars or whatever. So by that purchase, a little bit more fair, you know, on the sort of y-axis and the x-axis, you have state discrimination against minorities. And so what's really fascinating here is not only do you have a kind of geographical concurrence between the three sets of minorities that I talked about earlier, but you see, you know, the Africa 14 being high in freedom, lower in wealth, versus the Western 9 high in freedom, high in wealth, and then you see the big three at the top, you know, and relatively low levels of religious freedom. Here, it's a correlation chart between human freedoms in general and state discrimination against religious minorities in these 31 countries. This merely tells you something that's a bit counterintuitive, which is that when we look at these 30 minorities, the evidence shows that more freedom overall in a society, whether that's civil, economic or political freedoms, doesn't mean that the religious freedoms of minorities will necessarily be protected or high. Yeah. So we have to fight for them where they are actually individually threatened. So that's quite a big take home, because the big data is showing that the assumption that if you raise all freedoms in a society, you would automatically raise religious freedoms of minorities is not necessarily the case. And I think, you know, we could go into lots of reasons in each country, the political factors, cultural factors, whatever, why that might be the case. But we're merely saying here the big data is showing that statistically there's no correlation between the two. So I think that that's an important insight, which we probably need to go away and work on a bit more and to understand in individual cases why that is the case. And again, that could be another whole discussion, I think, on its own. So we do some conceptual work in the report. I kind of want to argue that ummah meaning here in its simplest sort of form is a Quranic concept, and so the Muhammadan ummah is an ethical concept. It's about those who believe in God, who enjoin good and forbid wrong and uphold justice, you know, or even-handed or moderate. So it's an ethical concept, and it's not tied to a territory. The idea of ummah is not tied to a territory. But one of the things I do, besides sort of going through the fundamentals of it being a normative concept for Muslims, I also want to argue that it's actually an analytical concept. What do I mean by that? So in other words, if let's say you want to ask the question, if Muslims mobilize as an ummah across ethnic and national lines, mobilize for a cause, let's say the Bosnian War in support of the Bosnians in the 1990s, which was a very wide mobilization of the ummah in support in many ways, probably chiefly political lobbying and charity. But there were other ways that they helped. You would say, well, how did that mobilization work? You know, what obstacles did it overcome? How were people mobilized? And what does a successful mobilization look like? You're not there applying a normative concept, you're applying an analytical one. You're trying to understand how it works in the world. And the reason why I argue that's important is that we need to look at when ummah mobilization is weak, and we conversely and understand why that is, and conversely we have to understand when it works in order to kind of see how normative values actually work in the world. I think it's incredibly important to play off our normative concept of ummah with actually how it's working or not working in the world, because otherwise we don't know how to make our norms or actuate them in the world, if I can put it that way. So, and I also then go on to suggest that we need a kind of, this is a quite contentious point, I think, but we need something like double political theology, because most Islamic political theology assumes Muslims are in power.
Yeah.
The 4 out of 5 Muslims who live in majority Muslim societies, who could assume that Islam would be the religion of the state and so on and so forth, right? That there could be some application of Sharia in today's world, at least in some parts of life. But we don't think about what is a desirable political theology for the 1 in 5 Muslims who live as minorities. So this is the thing, you know, what do we think through their political theology or not, or is it just going to be thought about in terms of exceptions? So, you know, fickle akaliyat or whatever, you know, you want to talk about, you know, do we think through that one in five, what Islamic political theology looks like for them? Now, I'm putting that as a provocation because I don't see that. I don't see that thing. I always think that we have to stand and in the minority context, the 400 million plus Muslims who are in the minority, and think about what majority Muslim rule looks like. That's what we're going to dialogue and discuss. And is it not, you know, what is the normative sort of role of a caliphate, for instance, for this, you know, 1.5 billion. But meanwhile, the 400 million plus who live in the minority situation for the time being, for the foreseeable future, you know, we don't talk about what normative Islamic political theology looks like, could look like for them.
Presumably because it seems a temporary, somewhat anomalous phenomenon rather than a normative, ongoing, permanent reality. So, you know, until the caliphate is restored or returned and so on, we're waiting, you know, that there is an element of kind of the tension between the provisional and the permanent in the majority world. And so this is kind of, they're not quite equal, are they? The majority, Muslim majority and minority world. So what one is provisional and the other is more permanent, or am I... What do you think?
Well, I'm arguing that operationally speaking, if you're concerned about people, the benefit and their welfare of these 400 million plus Muslims, some of whom are in very difficult positions, obviously, you know, there's an immediate duty of care. You know, I mean, if, you know, operationally speaking, the Ummah is one body. And as the hadith, famous hadith goes, if any one part, any limb or part of that body feels pain, the whole body feels that pain. And I'm assuming that that's not saying that the 400 million plus are sort of expendable, but in fact, we should have a duty of care towards them and to each other. So given that kind of, you know, and the blood, honor, and dignity and property of every Muslim is sacrosanct, this is another hadith, you know, we understand that there's no divisibility in that sense.
Right.
So that's why I'm putting this forward as a provocation, because I know there's not much thought been done on this, but it seems to me that we need to start thinking about it, not in order to undermine a normative Islamic political theology per se, but just to ask the question, are we going to have no discussion whatsoever about the one in five who don't live in a majority context?
Right. Yeah,
it seems, that seems madness to me, and beyond that, a kind of dereliction of duty. If anything,
that's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah.
So the third element is, you know, we need, if it's going to be an analytical concept, Ummah, it needs to be in a critical dialogue with things like the nation state, because the Ummah is not territorial. It also needs to be in a critical dialogue with the concept of minority itself, because minority, okay, it may be a kind of fact that we live with every day, but minority is more than just a kind of numerical concept. You know, minority comes out of the emergence of the nation state system in Europe in the 16th century, known as the Westphalian order, which, you know, creates bounded territories, and minorities are defined within that, loyalty to the prince and so on.
Yeah.
But the other aspect of minority, which is more salient to the Muslim experience, is colonialism. And so you had de facto tiny numerical colonial elites ruling over a majority population that was split up into minorities. So a kind of case of define, divide, and rule. So they're redefined as tribes, as ethnic groups, and as religions, in order to divide them and to rule them.
Yeah.
And so they were operational colonial minorities. And that was, again, a really important sense in which minority, so we are, I know, arguing the paper that minority is not a normative concept for us, but it is a reality we work from, if you see what I mean, but it's not normative.
I think that's an important clarification you made there. That's very helpful, actually. Thank you.
Yeah, and then I think the diaspora, it means, you know, originally meant a group of people scattered from their homeland, ejected, exiled from their homeland, And but they're bound, although they're scattered, they're bound by a shared identity, history, culture, and lost homeland. Today, it's an analytical concept used for not where the homeland is destroyed, the homeland remains, but you still have a dispersal of people from that homeland, and they identify and in real-time contact with their homeland and their families and so on. So you have transnational ties across nation-state borders. And the sort of the fifth term, really, we need to consider when we talk about Ummah analytically, is universalism. So, you know, Islam is a universal dispensation. So Ummah is a universal concept. But Muslims don't have the idea that we will transform the globe into that everybody will become Muslim. I mean, this is not even the sort of tacit reality of human diversity is by color or creed is recognized in the Quran. And yeah. So while we have a universal message, we recognize there are other peoples in the world who may hang on to their own ideas of universalism. But what's really important as Muslims that we can say that, you know, in our version of universalism is actually more likely to accept the deep pluralism than, say, liberal universalism.
Yes. Absolutely.
Liberal universalism wants, you know, recognizes a kind of limited pluralism in which people are accepted as moral agents if they are become liberals.
Yes.
But it has no place for the non-liberal, whereas in fact Islamic universalism is more deeply pluralistic than that,
yes,
because it accepts that there are going to be people who reject its message fundamentally, but yes, it doesn't cast them out from the world. If you see what I mean. So
it's an important point you make there. In the West, it's completely not understood. We see the West as emphasizing great diversity and tolerance and freedom and so on. But the irony is actually in a quite a narrow band of permitted ideologies and behaviors and worldviews. Whereas Islam actually is constitutionally in its DNA pluralist, right back to the Pact of Medina or the Constitution of Medina the Prophet himself, which gave legal recognition to non-Muslims, be they Christians, Jews, and pagans and others, to be part of the Ummah. And they were not required, obviously, to convert. They were given rights to practice their religion. This is not recognized in the West. You don't have polygamy is not recognized. A whole bunch of religious practices are not accepted in the West.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, this is what I allude to, you know, the two elements of Ummah, the two major elements in Ummah. One is the Quranic concept. And obviously, which, as I mentioned before, is unbordered. It's a universal concept. Yeah. It's not territorialized. It's an ethical concept centered on Quranic faith and justice. But as you say, the other major element that we draw from the Sirah is the Pact of Medina that comes after the Prophet, peace be upon him, comes to Medina and signs a pact with pagan Arabs and Jews and others. You know, that it would be a multi-confessional pact based on consultation and mutual security.
Yes.
And then, you know, meanwhile, you know, of course the Prophet has an arbitration role. But there's mutual security, and they accept that people are going to basically run their own affairs otherwise. So it's deeply pluralist in a way that isn't possible in a liberal order, where the law has to be equally applied across the territory.
Yeah, so, indiscriminately, without recognizing any differences. Like in France, obviously, French law is uniform, universal, absolute, and non-negotiable. Yeah. And it does, without recognizing any confessional whatsoever, it refuses to do so. Actually, as a matter of principle,
I mean, not every country is like France, and in Britain we have two legal systems, don't we? We have the Scottish and we have the English and Welsh one. But so there are kinks, and you know, we're talking broadly here. But you know, I agree that the fundamental point stands. So I go on to discuss in the report. Power. And why do I discuss power? Because for a couple of reasons. One is that Muslims, in my 30, 40 years experience of being part of the Ummah, Muslims tend to talk ourselves down. We tend to internalize a lot of, we can't be analytical and sober about the power that we do possess. and how we can use it to do good in the world. We often talk about how actually other forces are acting upon us, but not we never really talk about how we are acting and how we are actually shaping, to some degree, shaping the world, either as minorities or majorities. So there is a deliberate focus in this report, a corrective focus on power. But the other reason why I wanted to write about this, about Islamic power, is that there is a big danger of in trying to reclaim power that we create a kind of secularized, materialistic idea of power. So in other words, you know, there's a kind of, if you like, a hollowed out kind of Islamic empowerment for Muslims, which actually starts to leave aside the salvific and the spiritual and so on, you know. So in other words, it's just confined to the material world. And so that's why I wanted to kind of take this division by Joseph Nye, the famous American political scientist, who talks divides power into two, soft power and hard power. Soft power is persuasive power. Hard power is coercive power. In that, he doesn't just include military strength, but also economic power, because you can buy out, basically buy out, buy people out.
Well, so without getting distracted at all, I don't want to interrupt you too much, but when you talk about the soft power for Muslim minorities embodying Islamic virtues, what are we talking about in practice? Could you give an example of what that might mean? Could you illustrate that?
Okay, well, conceptually, let me put it like this. So conceptually, we could have a sequestered identity. So, for instance, you could say that actually our Islam is manifested in three institutions in the minority context. So it's manifested in family life primarily,
right?
But then the mosque,
right?
And then the madrasa. So I would say like those three are where you see Islam. Okay, but that if that were the case entirely, then nobody else would really know about Islam. There wouldn't be an embodiment of Islamic virtues in life, in the world, in setting an example by word and deed. So I mean, what I mean by this is anything outside of those core institutions where we embody Islamic virtues, this is how we show our what Islam is in our everyday lives. We have to show what it is.
An example I could think of then would be like, because Muslims in Britain are very famous for giving incredibly to charity, charitable causes, you know, huge amounts of money, and not just Muslim charities, but generally for the welfare of people and the homeless and the poor. And that would be, I suppose, embodying Islamic virtue, because zakat and giving to support the wayfarer and the poor and the marginalized is there in the Quran. It's a Quranic injunction. So that might be one way that would embody soft power in that way, perhaps.
Yeah, it's showing the reality of our lives, and I put here cultural, social, intellectual, and political. So in all of those domains, we have to embody. And that, you know, the prophets, Salatu wassalam, you know, they embodied the message by word and by example. And I think it's important to say by example.
Yeah.
It's not just a discursive. It's not just about having the best arguments, is it? It's about being exemplary, being an example. I think it's so important. If we don't embody, but we just talk about Islamic virtues, I think we're missing a huge point of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, that he was embodied Quran. He was a walking Quran. And so that is where we might slip up. If we think that actually Islam in the wider world is just a discursive argument, right, I think we'll be missing a huge trick there, and missing, I think, that one of the largest, if not the largest, lessons of the seerah and the lives of the prophets. So hard power, here, this is for Muslim minorities, so I'm not talking about Muslim majorities that have armies and whatnot. For minorities, you know, I would suggest that it's civil disobedience against discriminatory policies. So, for instance, you know, we withdraw our consent or participation from directly discriminatory policies. So we have to protest them. And then that's a negative action. But then on top of that, because hard power includes economic power, it's things like the Muslim minority promotes trade with the Muslim majority world. We send remittances already. You know, it's very interesting, Paul, that remittances are, we talk about in the report, remittances are 1.5 times larger than foreign direct investment in the Muslim world. Mm. And on top of that, they are 3 times as big as aid and development budgets. Right. So already...
What is remittances? Sorry.
So remittances are payments from one part of a family to another part of family transnationally across national borders.
Interesting.
It's one of those things, the remittance is one of those things that goes completely under the radar in terms of our community debate and discussion. But in fact, it's incredibly important. It's incredibly important. Philanthropy, we talked about earlier, but one of the other pieces of research that the Ayan Institute is doing is that we're doing another big report on Muslim charitable giving in the UK, that British Muslims contribute £700 million per year in philanthropy. And that's the headline figure that we found. And obviously, that might be a little bit low because that was, most of the research was done during COVID. So the other thing is that is about the transfer of skills and expertise locally and globally. So again, you know, this is way in which we're talking about the power that Muslim minorities wield. We do have, say, the Western Nine or the Western Ten, if we include Sweden. Yeah. It does have skills, expertise. We do give a lot of philanthropy. We have the ability to promote trade, the ability to, if you like, organize against discriminatory policies against Muslim minorities and majorities. So we have all these things are in our hands, and this is forms of power that we possess. And so I think it's so important for us to understand these as forms of power. So going back to a kind of political theology for Muslim minorities, this is not that. But these are sort of 4 things, and I'm sure we could add other things, but these are kind of 4 things that I view as important. That, you know, of course, we're not talking about societies where in China and India, where Muslim minorities are being crushed. Mm. Here we're talking about minorities where they have some agency, some room for maneuver. Mm. We're probably largely talking about the Africa 14 and the Western Nine at this point, and probably more the Western Nine. But you know, the one thing is saving democracy from big finance capital and big business. Obviously, you know, we're kind of the democracy is being hollowed out, and we've sort of become oligarchies with moments of electoral democracy. But otherwise, it seems that it's business as usual. Mm-hmm. The second thing is that, to touch on our earlier conversation, we need to push very hard for deep pluralism, i.e. post-liberal pluralism in societies. Mm-hmm. Because if we want Muslim minorities to thrive, they can't really operate in systems where they're going to be reconstructed as liberals, root and branch, through the education system. So we have to work for deep pluralism. That may not create a society where that looks Islamic, but it will be a society where Muslim minorities can live peacefully and thrive in their own terms. Mm. And maybe that's all we could expect for minorities. That's another whole debate and big debate for another day. The third is that, you know, I believe that we have to make anti-Islamophobia central to anti-racism. The reason why I say this is because, you know, in the last 20 years, Islamophobia has been baked into the structure of the security state after 9/11. It's absolutely central to how those systems operate. And so the old kind of secular anti-racism, where Muslims were expected to protest racist violence but leave their religion at the door, I think those days are over. And we need to actually insist, really, especially to a younger generation of young Muslims who've been drawn towards a kind of, I describe it as a sort of Bismillah anti-racism. So a kind of, you know, okay, they have Muslim identities, they could even be recognized, but at no point really do they bring their Islamic values to bear upon tackling racism and discrimination and Islamophobia. And the thing is, you know, we all know, we all learn from at the beginning that Islam The Quran mentions that, you know, the real distinction between human beings is taqwa, is piety, and it's not actually external matters like skin type or what country you hail from or what language you speak or whatever it is. It's actually conduct, it's character, it's piety. This is the thing that ultimately distinguishes people. Islam is anti-racist in its DNA. But sadly, you know, we don't always live up to that in our own communities, and we certainly don't stand up for it. But it seems to me that if we take a kind of we take that message of character and conduct being the key thing, in whichever society we find ourselves, we don't want to have prejudicial structures in place that if you like, don't put character and conduct at the center of the idea of merit in a society. So wherever we are, Muslims minorities need to bear witness to that fundamental truth and work towards it. Mm-hmm. And the fourth thing is, as I was saying before, we do need to protect Muslim minority rights in their own, as a separate channel of concern, because I don't believe that just raising the bar of all rights will necessarily mean that Muslim minority rights will be protected. So they need special attention and care.
I notice in your list, I mean, it's often spoken of under the radar. I don't want to divert in any way your presentation here, and I realize I'm opening up a can of worms here, but I just wanted to kind of just say it anyway, is the whole idea of hijra. A lot of people I know talk about leaving, whether it be Britain or whatever, to hopefully a better place. Wherever this place will be, of course, is the question. Will it be Indonesia? Is it Turkey is a favorite destination at the moment. When I was there, a lot of reverts have gone to Turkey, a much more welcoming place where they're not, that the families are not, their children are not indoctrinated with certain ideas they find elsewhere. But you seem to be assuming an established, settled minority in the West where hijra is simply not discussed. It is simply not on the radar. But for many Muslims, do want to think about the options of leaving, because the conditions are becoming, you talk about pre-genocidal problems in India, but in Europe, the conditions are in Sweden, for example, I spoke to Dr. Abdullah Sweedy about this, are becoming more and more harsh towards Muslims, that they're not stabilizing, they're actually getting worse. And his prognosis was quite pessimistic about the future of Muslims as minorities in Europe. So are you assuming we'll just stay and not leave? And if we, or is this not an issue, perhaps?
Where I stand on this issue of hijra is that, of course, in the Islamic tradition, that the earth is vast and wide, and you can flee oppression. Obviously, you know, we live in a kind of contradictory world. We have many Muslims fleeing persecution and war to settle in Europe at the moment, in the last decade. Hundreds of thousands of Muslims have made the choice to come to Europe because they feel they're going to have basic security and they're not going to be killed. And meanwhile, we have Muslims who've grown up in Europe saying, actually, you know, I don't like the way the influence is on my kids, or I don't like the way my wife is being looked at in the street or whatever. I don't feel comfortable here. I want to move. So, you know, it is a complex mixed up picture. But I, you know, if you look at the 20th century, 19th and 20th centuries, you know, you've had lots of calls for hijra, for migration in the past, but only a minority ever heeded that call. And in the end, you ended up with, let's take the partition of British India. You know, you still end up with this huge minority. Whose political future one needs to worry about. There was no prospect that all of India's Muslims were going to relocate to Pakistan and Bangladesh. I mean, that was never going to happen. So there is a kind of, if we're being a little bit pragmatic here, there's always going to be the call for hijra is only ever going to be for a minority. Mm. I mean, the vast majority are going to stay put.
Yeah.
And so as a responsible community, we need to not, to be less preoccupied by the romance of the idea of hijra and actually focus a lot more on how do we actually just help our communities to survive, number one, and number two, to thrive. Right. We have to at least hold out the hope that we can do more than just survive.
Okay.
My point is that, you know, we need to articulate where we'd like to head in order that we can start to work towards it. I mean, the worst thing is to be in a kind of permanent crisis mode where it's hopeless and we just have to make hijra, because only a minority are ever going to do that.
Because are ever going to have the resources and the wealth and the opportunities to do that. You have to have money to emigrate, to buy property, to literally move anyway. So a lot of poor people sit, there's not going to be a realistic option anyway.
Look, wherever we are, Paul, wherever you go in the world, there'll be other problems there. It's not like there may be different kinds of problems, but you know, there's no Jannah, there's no paradise in the world. You know, I think wherever Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala places us in the world, you know, we have to, I don't think everybody should just run away. I think, you know, we have to accept that we have to build, and we have to, you know, we have to build something, we have to do something.
Yeah.
We have to have a focus on building institutions, and that's the next thing I should really talk about here, which is that, you know, I did a sort of 130-year sort of survey of Muslims in the West, and what did they do to build institutions? What did they do to do more than survive? What did they do to thrive? And so, you know, I kind of mentioned 10 things here. You know, the top three are all kind of saying the same thing, but don't do your politics in nationalist silos. Connect with the wider ummah. It's very, very important, because, and this is what all of our pioneers did, and as communities become better established and become culturally assimilated to some degree, we need to make a conscious effort to remain connected to ummah. So, you know, in our generation, that there's been a big move towards saying that we have to sort out our homeland politics first. You know, we can't think about the ummah. It's too much, and we'll be stigmatized. You know, we'll make ourselves targets if we do that. But I would turn that around and suggest that that is the political challenge of our generation. Our political challenge is to do both at once. To act locally and to think globally or automatically, to think locally, to think about local welfare, but also to act globally. So either act or think locally, or act or think globally at the same time. It's that balancing act that is our challenge. If the ummah is really one body, you know, we have to remember it's not that the ummah is over there somewhere, suffering from an earthquake or whatever it is, and we're sending over money. That the ummah is also on our doorstep, and we also have to take our champion at point two, champion your cause of the ummah. It's not like the cause of British Muslims is just for British Muslims and it's like a nationalist thing. No, we have certain cross-cutting issues, like, for instance, prevent. Okay, so the prevent policy is a counter-terrorism policy developed in Britain, which has been exported globally, which is why it matters, you know, globally. But of all the Western countries, Britain is the most securitized state out of all of those 38. We have more provisions, more policies and laws than any of those other 38 countries. So you know, the British Muslim community has done the most research, the most analysis, has provided kind of thought leadership on this. And that's why the institutions we built in the last 20 years to look at the securitization of Muslim minorities is very important for others around the world. So we have made that cause an ummatic cause. All I'm saying is it's possible to do it. We shouldn't think that our politics is just parochial. So in other words, a strong Muslim minority is one that thinks about the ummah in a connected way. That doesn't mean that we prioritize the majority over the minority or the minority over the majority. We have to do both at once. And so to do that, we need independent institutions. We need to build alliances and coalitions within our society. We need to empower our community materially and spiritually. As I've been saying, I don't think empowerment should be a material concept only. We have to keep calling to Islam, calling people to Islam, because Islam is not an ethnicized religion. Okay, we have to, it's a universal dispensation of the Prophet, and whichever society we find ourselves in, we need to make that universal call. I mean, in an age of postmodernism, to make a call to universalism is itself probably the most subversive thing you can do today.
Yes.
But we have to insist on that and not forget it. There's a big, huge pressure on us to drop universal claims in the name of Islam.
Yes.
We have to actually resist that.
Yeah, the zeitgeist is so powerful that, as you say, all truth is relative, and we can't make these meta-narrative claims, and we can't say there is the truth. The truth is, you know, there is God, one God. This is sort of very socially taboo. You're supposed to allow plurality of metaphysics and philosophies as a normative reality, but of course that's simply not possible Islamically, because the Quran is extremely clear on this.
And of course, you know, we of course, as we said earlier, that doesn't, deep pluralism can still be part of any universal claim to truth. So it's dividing the epistemological questions from the project of living together, right?
Exactly. And if people don't get this, I was speaking to a guy yesterday who couldn't understand if Islam makes a claim to absolute truth, therefore it must be intolerant and suppress any opposition to that. No. That's a kind of a Christian worldview where if you had a particular religious, a particular confessional position as a Christian nation, like the Church of England, then you ban the Catholics, you ban everyone else. In Islam, as you say, that the pluralism is part of the DNA of the religion itself, even though the belief system is absolutist. It very much permits and allows others to exist and flourish within their own terms.
Yeah, the God doesn't want forced love and devotion. This is the thing. It's not Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is not a tyrant who wants to compel people to believe. This is the I guess the gift of human freedom, right? That we have to choose to love Him and to be devoted to Him. He's not interested in forced love.
And the Quran, Peter Lee says this, of course. This is not just the Quranic.
No, I'm putting it in a street language, but I just think that it makes complete sense to me. Why would you link epistemological unity with political unity? If you see what I mean? The kind of Westphalian logic, if you like. The religion of the prince is the religion of the state.
Exactly.
It's the religion of, and you could have some tolerated minorities, but you know they could be very much under pressure, as they were. So the ninth point is that Muslim women should be at the heart of community leadership. It seems to me that in my 30 years experience, at least, that whenever I work with community organizations where women and men shared leadership, we provided we developed solutions that were much more holistic. All the dots were connected, if I can put it that way. So between public life and family life, in a holistic way, we saw how all issues were connected. Because quite often, you know, when you have problems and challenges, actually you need approaches that are coming at all different levels of community life. And what I've found is that if you split that leadership, you get split solutions they're only holding on, you know, one part of the elephant, if you know what I mean, like holding onto the tail, somebody else is holding onto the trunk. Actually, you need joint leadership in order to actually really come up with holistic solutions. The 10th one is prioritizing creative and media skills. The reason why I say that is because many of our Muslim creatives actually have to go outside of the Muslim community for support. And then that means that they're really performing their creativity for a kind of secular audience. Actually, what you really want is them being able to kind of expand the definition of what it means to be human, the non-liberal human, if I like, or the theist, the theocrat, also is a human being. So, I mean, the point of the creative expression is it can't all be about, you know, discursive arguments. Theological argument, that's how we present that. No, it has to come through cultural expression, through, you know, through poetry and film and song and so on. And on top of that, we need to really invest in media skills, because as you know, like every 18 months, there's a new platform, there's a new app, and it's driving a new form of cultural expression. You know what I mean? We retraining seems to be very, very constant at the moment. In the noughties, it was blogs, right? Now it's podcasts, and maybe it will change again, depending on the technology and where it goes. So obviously we're always playing catch up. So I'll end here, the presentation here. You know, we need to, you know, the Iron Institute is really interested in, I like, the next three steps, rather than the next 20, you know, thinking 20 steps ahead. Because, you know, the way that we empower our communities is to make them think about the next few steps they can take with something that, that they can grasp, something that's in their hands already. So we need to sort of foster these independent spaces for borderless automatic networks, you know, to build solidarity, knowledge, expertise, and capacity that model post-national global solidarity for humanity at large. The reason why I say that is because if we go back to the original map that I showed at the beginning of this, you know, we have the core of the Muslim world, and then we have these minorities in India, in Russia, China, Africa, and the Americas and Europe. If those minorities are effectively plugged into the core, then we are modeling global solidarity for humanity at large, because every single major civilization will be part of a connected ummah. Once we revive our civilization, you know, we can model that solidarity for humanity. You know, Muslims can model how to live with profound difference for the rest of humanity. Yeah, and so why do I think it's important? I don't think it's just a kumbaya thing, if you know what I mean.
I hate that expression. I hate that. I hope it dies and withers on the vine.
No, but you know what? I'm saying it deliberately. I'm saying it as a provocation. No,
I know.
It's but yeah, it's not all about peace and love. Hajj and Umrah. You know, I mean, you know, in other words, you know, cultural difference is an asset. It's not a problem. Islam doesn't see it as a problem. It sees it as an asset. And if we can make that to work for us and get rid of the kind of nationalist bug that has infected us, then we can actually show everyone else how we can deal with planetary challenges like the climate crisis. You know, it seems to me that nationalist competition is stopping us from cooperating on really big issues. I mean, you know, like, you see glimpses of it, don't you, at the beginning of the COVID pandemic, at the beginning, when, for instance, big pharma companies and governments and universities and so on dropped all of their sort of borders of knowledge, and they collaborated in real time in the race to formulate a vaccine. And at the moment that they did that massive mobilization of resources, all of a sudden, which was global, all of a sudden you see what's possible when there's intense cooperation rather than intense competition. And that's what I'm saying to you, that with these big challenges that we have, like the climate crisis, we need to somehow get to something like that. Because at the moment, all I see is a lot of nationalist competition and rivalry, rather than a kind of deep collaboration where we need it, where it would be rational, you know, to want to seek that. So I'll end it there. If you want to,
I'll bring you back, just the two of us. Cool. That was extremely interesting. Thank you very much, Yoha, for that. I just one point about the elephant in the room, in the way you very briefly touched on it early on. And that was the place or role that the in the aspirations and the imagination and the thinking and the politicizing of the Ummah, minority and majority in the world, of the return of the caliphate, and what role and place does that have in our thinking, if not in the reality? I take it it's not here, but now, but in our thinking. I just want to just read a sentence from this rather interesting book by Dr. Reza Pankhurst, called the Inevitable Caliphate, A History of the Struggle for Global Islamic Union, 1924 to the present, which I've read. And it's just on page 16, he writes just one thing. In his view, he refers to what he considers to be the classic orthodox Islamic position, which holds, he says, that there is an indisputable consensus that there should be a single ruler for the Muslim community, and that this ruler is charged with the ruling by the law of God. Excuse me. The basis for this kind of unequivocal consensus, he says, is the abundance of clear evidence that can be found in the primary sources of Islam, the Quran and the prophetic narrations, which make these two points explicitly clear. Now, I know in your report, you're dealing with realities as they are. You're looking at the realities of minority living in the West and in Africa and so on. But what role or place does the return of the caliphate play in the political aspirations of the Ummah, everyone in minority and majority context, do you think?
Yeah, the report does go into it does describe the post-caliphate world. So what the report does say that in the post-caliphate world, which the Ottoman claim to the caliphate was widely recognized amongst Muslims, but it was never universally recognized. We have to be clear about that, but it was widely recognized. It was the last great Muslim power. You know, some people, the Moroccans will claim that they have a caliphate in their kingdom, which is unbroken as well. We could call it the far Islamic West. So in the post-Ottoman world or the post-caliphate world, certainly it left a big hole because, 600 years of duration and at least, 300-400 years in the Central Middle East, North Africa and so on, it was a time of relative peace in that region, certainly far more peaceful than it has been, during European colonialism and after. So there is a kind of a feeling of loss for sure in the heartlands of the Muslim world. For a loss of a great Muslim power, a champion, a champion that would stand up for the Muslims of India, as we were talking earlier, if you had a great champion in the world, then we would all probably sleep a little bit easier. We probably all breathe a little bit easier. But none of us see any immediate prospect of that. So, in a context where, in fact, actually, I would break it down to something much more simple at the moment, is that we need to build a feeling of Muslim solidarity in the first place. So, in other words, Muslim solidarity is not like an infinite resource. It's not like water on tap. That feeling of solidarity with Muslims everywhere, which I take to be a kind of foundational level at which you would aspire to be more unified, you would aspire to help one another, to aid one another, to care for one another, and so on. That's the ground, the basis upon which you would have a more unified Muslim power in the world. Because without that sentiment, I don't see how you could have that. And what I'm trying to say is, I think in a world where we're all divided up into nation states, either as minorities or majorities, we need to actually start building that solidarity. That's why I say at the end of the report that, we need to build connectivity, and not just in a kind of abstract sense of what do you teach kids at madrasa. I mean things much more like, only less than 5% of the trade in the Muslim world is with other Muslim countries. Most of the trade is external. So for instance, just building intra-Muslim trade or building it cultural exchanges between schools and universities, exchange of academic staff. In other words, the internet provides us a great opportunity now to talk across borders, to compare notes, and to come to a kind, to create global conversations about our collective future. So the internet is our great ally in that sense. It's our great, that technological shift is our great ally.
It is.
But it's not the full stop of it. It's just one tool. The others have to be in real life exchanges, cultural exchanges, to build a feeling of a practical solidarity. And the reason why I say that has to, I have relatively little faith at the moment in existing nation states to do that conscientiously. If anything, they're trying to use Islamic power to buttress their legitimacy. Or even to actually push down Muslim minorities where they feel they're speaking out of turn. The UAE, the United Arab Emirates, for instance, is a good example of this, in the last decade or so, they've played quite a big role in trying to, for instance, interfere in American Muslim politics. It's not just about what people are saying about the Emirates or whatever, you know. So actually, there are real issues. So the thing is that, you know, I think that Muslim minorities have to talk back to Muslim majorities, but often it would be more productive if we're bypassing the states, these states that are sort of hyper pushing kind of hyper religious nationalism. You know, we need to actually kind of restart the conversation. So for me, in my thinking, honestly, and in the thinking of the Iron Institute, we need to be thinking about these very practical immediate steps. Some people might interpret that as a kind of a dereliction of duty, that we're not focused upon kind of creedal discussions of around political theology of Muslims. But I see something different. I see a generation losing touch with this feeling of Muslim solidarity. And so I think we need to find practical, conscientious ways to reinforce that in real time for our young people.
It could be that both approaches are complementary, actually, rather than mutually exclusive, that you're just emphasizing different facets of the whole.
No, I don't see why creedal discussions would have any direct bearing on this. But I see a bigger gap in these kind of concrete ways of building the feeling of solidarity, which I think is groundwork that must be done. It has to be done. Because otherwise we could just become national minorities and no longer regard ourselves other than pay lip service to the idea of Muslims, wider Muslim solidarity. So I see that as the primary force acting on these minorities. And so we need to conscientiously take concrete steps to counteract it, not just in terms of how we teach political theology, if you see what I mean. We need to just...
I think, well, what you're saying in a British context is perfectly fine, and I certainly appreciate what you're saying. And you're not addressing other countries. I keep on thinking of France. If you were to say what you're saying now in France as a French Muslim, that would be subversive. It would be a threat. It would be perceived, I think, as a threat to the state, because you're not giving obeisance to the French state. You're talking transnationally. You're talking about another political, unofficial entity, the Ummah, and the allegiances to that. I'm not in any way criticizing what you're saying. I don't mean it that way. I mean, I'm just saying that we can speak like this in our, perhaps our context in Britain and maybe in the States without it triggering too many people. I think in some countries, there would be a backlash by the state. And France is very hot on this kind of thing, as we know from recent expulsions of imams and so on. So I know you're not just saying... It's quite challenging thing to say in some context.
You know, you have to stand up and you know, you have to do a Malcolm X. I mean, Malcolm X took the cause of Black America and made it a nomadic and international human rights issue. You know, after he left the Nation of Islam, he toured Africa, he toured the Middle East, he met heads of state, he made it an international issue. I mean, the Americans, the CIA and the American political establishment absolutely hated him for it and demonized him for it, but he laid the groundwork, a really important groundwork, which others built on later on. And he said that the civil rights of the African Americans should never be a parochial issue. And so the plight of the Muslims in France, they have to build out, which they're starting to do, they need to build outwards networks of solidarity and support. They shouldn't do this on their own. We should be ready to help them.
How challenging is it going to be? And you're not denying this, but it's going to be more challenging for some minorities than others to do this.
No, we have to walk into the challenge. That's what I'm saying to you. Look, France is not China or India.
Not yet.
At the moment. Not yet. But it doesn't mean that it doesn't mean that let's hedge our bets and all move to Istanbul. It means that there's going to be a fight. We're going to have a fight on our hands, a political fight. And I'm saying, don't do that on your own. Build alliances within France. Reconstitute the left in France so it's not anti-Islamophobic, but it's actually going to fight, protect the civil rights of Muslim organizations who are currently being shut, like their big charities and their advocacy groups are being shut down. So and that's partly because the French left became divided. If the French left were stronger then those shutdowns wouldn't have happened. Sarkozy wouldn't have been pulled to the right by Marine Le Pen. So you have that on one side. On the other side, you've got the fact that there's very draconian measures happening in France, it is becoming an international issue. So we have to lean into that, and we have to work hard for that. So I'm not saying any of this is necessarily easy.
No.
I'm just saying the answer is not to talk about Hijra and talk about the theological niceties of the caliphate. We have to actually just get our hands dirty and get stuck in and actually try to protect what rights we have, improve them if we can, but we shouldn't just make our Islam a kind of academic exercise. We've got to actually act and work in the world together and do what we can. I always take one of the hadith narrations that always always inspires me is the one where the prophet counseled that even if the trumpet is sounded for the day of judgment,
yes,
and you're planting a tree,
finish
the job of planting the tree. And I always take hope from that, okay, no matter how bad things seem, you still have, if you're trying to do good in the world, that you don't stop, you finish the job, you carry acting in the world. We believe, how many times the Quran always joins together belief and good acts in the world. Believe and do good. Again and again, these two things are joined. And we're not just believers, we're doers as well.
Mm-hmm.
We act in the world. And so we have to have those two together. And we have to act justly and with moderation, as the Quran commands us to. We carry on. Keep calm and carry on.
Carry on, yeah. That's a bit of a creed for no. That's fantastic. I do commend your report. For what it's worth, me recommending it. But I'll link to it in the description below. Uma at the margins: the past, present, and future of Muslim minorities. An absolutely fascinating, extremely well researched, and erudite report. As I say, I do highly recommend people familiarize themselves with the contents and think. As you say, you're starting a conversation. You're not being a kind of a magisterium that's teaching and issuing diktats from on high.
the minute I said it was a magisterium, my life would be over.
The idea of an Islamic magisterium from West Yorkshire is nonetheless has an appeal, perhaps, but not on this occasion, at least. That's not what you're doing. You're very, very kind of mature and opening up lines of thought and discussion. Which is extremely interesting. So thank you very much indeed for your presentation. Extremely excellent work, and we look forward to future contributions from you as well. And I guess that's it. Don't want to detain you any further, but thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much for having me, Paul.
Take care. Until next time.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.